Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the world's largest music festival, Milwaukee Summerfest, begins on Wednesday. There'll be a lot of big names, but we'll check in on some Wisconsin acts that you shouldn't miss.
First, we're talking about a new idea here in Wisconsin that could help people to save for the care they might need when they get older.
A lot of people need help with everyday tasks once they reach a certain age, but less than 8% of Americans have long-term care insurance to help pay for that kind of assistance. That's one of the reasons our next guest is proposing a new way for people to save for long-term care.
Ingrid Thompson is with us. She's the director of McFarland Senior Outreach Services. Ingrid, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me today.
So how did you first get the idea to create a new way to save for long-term care?
Well, this came from my own personal experience. I have parents who are in the 90s, and they had paid into long-term care insurance. But when they needed it, they found that they had to go through a lot of hoops and red tape, and they had to submit paper after paper, and it became quite tiresome for them to get the money that they actually contributed to this insurance policy. And the other thing was my personal experience. As I was growing older, I was thinking that that would be a good option for me to have. But as I looked at my budget, I wasn't sure that I could finance it. And so I was really struggling with that concept, knowing that I thought I wanted it, but yet I didn't think I could afford it.
Now let's get to the bones of the plan. It has a lot in common with EdVest, which is a popular way for people to save for college. How does it compare? How does it work?
Well, that's the first thing I thought of when I came up with this concept was it seemed fairly simple that in EdVest, not only could an individual put money into their account, but typically it was other people. It was parents, aunts and uncles, grandparents that were trying to set aside some money for somebody's education. So in this concept, it would be where an individual could put money into their own account. This person would, the account holder would be 18 years old or older. But let's say I had a child that wanted to give me a Mother's Day gift and wasn't sure what she wanted to give me, so she deposits some money into my account. So this account would be, there would be an account holder, but other people who are interested in somebody's welfare and long-term care could contribute to this fund.
And so this is a group approach. This is sort of the village approach to long-term care.
Yes, it is.
Why do you think that we need a plan like this if there are already private long-term care insurance companies who can provide this or Medicaid, for instance?
Well, in terms of long-term care insurance, I'm in a subcommittee that has researched this, and we have found out that the long-term care insurance is probably going to be phased out. And the reason why they're going to probably phase this out is because they have found that it's hard to predict 20 and 30 years out what the cost of the various things that people need are going to be. And they sometimes can't predict what services are out there. So if I had bought my insurance policy 30 years ago, I might not have adequate coverage to be able to get what I need, or there might be some new services that have been made available to me that was not even part of the plan.
And the price of long-term care insurance is, it's pretty well known to be rather expensive, and that's been prohibitive for some people. Do you think that this would address just the cost of it all?
We're certainly hoping so. Like I said, I think that people can contribute at their own pace. For example, if you have the long-term care insurance, you've got a premium. That's what you have to pay. Whereas if you have this savings account, you can put in $20 this month, $100 next month. You can do it at your own pace and when you have the funds available to you.
Can you give us a sense of why you think it's important and what the statistics have to say as well about why it's important that people save for elder care?
Well, there are a lot of expenses out there. Having worked with older adults for over 25 years, that's one of their scariest things. Do I have the money to cover the things that I'm going to need as my health declines? And they're finding that they can't. They can't access it as well as that they want to.
And I think that I read something that reflected a statistic saying that only 8% of people have long-term care insurance. Is that right?
Absolutely. So having an investment fund like this would open it up to a lot more people.
And what kind of response? You have this idea for this plan. What came next? Because now we're seeing it as a presentation in the paper. How did it get from your idea to where we are today?
Well, the first thing, I happened to be a member of the Wisconsin Aging Advocacy Network and presented the idea to them, and they formed a subcommittee to help me with this. And from there, we started to fine-tune it. And once we felt it was in the way we felt it should be and finalized as much as we could, I went to my legislators, which happens to be Senator Mark Miller and Representative Rob Cole. And I sat down with them and Laura Rose from the Wisconsin Legislative Council, and we went through it, and they were very intrigued with the idea. And from that point on, a draft was made of this bill, and the draft was came back to me a little while ago, and I sat down with my legislators again, and we reviewed it, and we modified it and fine-tuned it. We're starting to do a little bit more research on it, and I'm hoping that I'll get the next draft of it fairly soon. And I've also presented it to the Dane County legislators in a separate meeting through another advocacy organization that I had. And so bit by bit, we're trying to put it out there and see what the public and the legislators think about this concept.
How unique is this plan as far as you know?
As far as we know, there is none in any state in the United States. We did some preliminary research, and we don't believe that there's any other state that offers this concept.
So this would be law. It's your baby. Do you have dreams of it going national one day?
Would love to. Would love to. If it's successful and people feel it's a viable option, we would love to have it go beyond Wisconsin.
Have you, you're working with a couple of legislators, as you said, but have you gotten any sort of feelers from other people saying, you know, this is interesting and I'm interested from maybe both sides of the aisle?
Well, I think what happened is this subcommittee, there are a variety of people on the subcommittee, and we went far and wide. There were about 50 different organizations we tapped into and individuals in a variety of different professions, and they all said, let's go for it. Let's really pursue this and see if we can make this happen.
So obviously getting a law like this passed is something that you have a lot invested in. What is your hope about how it would affect people and how they move into their later years in life?
I hope this will provide them some more security, that they feel that they have some funds that can be made available to them at the time that they need it. And the nice benefit of this is that if they don't use all of their long-term care insurance, their beneficiary can also use it for their long-term care insurance. So it would be passed down to another generation if there is any funds left over. So it would continue to pay for long-term care.
Well, Ingrid, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your plan with us today.
Thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking to Ingrid Thompson, Director of McFarland Senior Outreach Services.
With over 700 bands, a million attendees, and 11 stages used over 11 days, Milwaukee's Summerfest has been certified by the Guinness Book of World Records as the largest music festival on the planet.
And a festival that big attracts all kinds of big names, from Bruno Mars to Brad Paisley, Lady Gaga to Usher, Outkast to Girl Talk. Those artists tour nationally and even globally, but if you want a uniquely Wisconsin musical experience at this year's Summerfest, there are lots of local acts, too.
Here with us to share some unmissable Wisconsin acts, we have Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music writer Piet Levy. Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Guys, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, before we get to the Wisconsin stuff specifically, what are you looking forward to the most at this year's Summerfest?
Oh, that's a good question and a hard one to answer. I think that this is a really good lineup this year. I've written about this before. It seems to me to be, for the years I've covered it as a freelance writer and full-time as a music writer at the Journal Sentinel, I think it's the best lineup they've had since I've covered it. There's just a lot of modern, relevant, kind of youthful acts. You talked about Bruno Mars, Lady Gaga, Luke Bryan is just the top of the country world right now. Outkast, Reunited Outkast is playing. One Republic is playing. You've got New Order. You've got Fall Out Boy, Paramore. You know, it's just there's a lot of really good stuff. Usher, it's his only U.S. Summer date,
really,
and he's playing closing night. Yeah, it's a really good lineup. I'm really impressed by it, and I think a lot of people are.
So those are the national names. Let's dig into Wisconsin now. And in a piece you wrote, a preview piece, you picked a list of the top local artists to check out for each day, and we're going to survey some of those. They kick it off Wednesday, the 25th, and you chose the band Tweed Funk. Tell us a little bit about them, please.
Yeah, Tweed Funk is just a really fun, kind of funky soul band. You know, they had an album that came out a month or two ago, maybe, called First Name Lucky. And I listened to it, and it was just a really kind of, you know, it's just really good soul funk music. It just, you feel good listening to it. I was tapping my toes, all that kind of stuff. And that's on the album. I think live, they're going to be much more exciting. I think generally those kinds of songs are much better live than even on record. And on record, it was a lot of fun. And the cool thing, too, is it's a blend of originals and covers. And the originals sound just as good as the covers, which I think is really a testament that, you know, they sounded, their own songs sound just as good as some older, a little more time-tested soul gems. So it's definitely one to check out for sure.
And we've got a clip of them. We've got a clip of their song Sugarfoot to check out.
Cool.
Sugarfoot called me last night. He said his girl called him up. She said, can I come over? He said, yeah.
And you can see where that's going to translate really well on the stage, I think, Piet. I see what you were talking about.
Oh, it's so much fun. And they're playing at 5 o'clock on Johnson Controls World Soundstage. So definitely worth getting there and starting out your festa in the afternoon if you can for them. Yeah, it's going to be a blast, I'm sure.
And then Thursday, you picked a local throwback to the late 70s and early 80s. Tell us about Yipes.
Yeah, this is of all the local acts playing this year, this is maybe the most interesting booking. Yipes was a power pop band. It featured Pat McCurdy, who a lot of people know who he is, and he's played Summerfest over and over and over again in a million other places around the state and beyond. Mike Hoffman from Semi-Twang is also in that group. So they were together in the late 70s, early 80s. They actually got a record deal, released two albums within like 3 years. They did some shows, like opening for Cheap Trick. They opened for Foreigner. But the sales were kind of lackluster, even though the songs are good. So they were dropped, and the band just kind of disbanded, and McCurdy went and did his thing, and Hoffman did his thing, and they all kind of did their own thing. So last year at the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards, they were inducted into the Whammy Hall of Fame, and they came back together to play like a 15-minute set of songs. It seemed like kind of maybe a one-time sort of deal, but apparently they're coming back for more, and this time they're going to play a lot more than 15 minutes. So I think that'll be a lot of fun, too.
We've got Out in California from a 1979 album, I guess, before the label dropped, and let's give a listen. Sounds a little like late 70s, almost surf punk there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just kind of light and fun, and I think it'll be cool. And, you know, all those guys are all still pretty active. They're still at it. So, you know, they sounded good when they were together for 15 minutes. I think that they'll still sound pretty solid for a full set. So they're actually headlining a night of other Wisconsin bands that have gotten together. So there's going to be a few throwback bands on that stage. It's Johnson Controls World Sound Stage, the 26th. Yipes plays at 10 p.m.
Who are some of those other bands getting back together for that show?
Oh, man.
You've got them off the top of your head.
Oh, I'm trying to remember. Oh my gosh, because you've got me. Because there's so many band names kind of floating around in my
Yeah,
head.
I bet.
I'm totally
11 stages, 11 days. You do the math. Yeah, that's a lot out there.
Oh, there's some good ones whose names totally escape me, embarrassingly. And if they pop in my brain during our little chat, I will give a little shout out. Yeah,
I'm going to jump to the last couple days of the show. People getting out there on the holidays can check out Harvey Scales, Milwaukee's own, I understand, grandfather of soul. Can you tell us a little bit about Harvey Scales?
Yeah, Harvey Scales, he's 71. He lives in Atlanta now. But yeah, he is kind of known as the godfather of soul. He had a couple hits. One was called Love Itis. One was called Disco Lady. There's actually in Milwaukee, there's this thing called The Get Down. And it's this monthly vintage soul and funk dance party. And they play, national stuff. A lot of it's very rare. But they also play a lot of local stuff, too. And there's actually a song called The Get Down, I believe by Harvey Scales. So, he's kind of seen, his stuff will kind of appear in those dance set lists. So, for anyone who's kind of going to those parties, those parties, by the way, are just a lot of fun. You should definitely check it out if you can, if you're in Milwaukee for one of those. But this is a chance to kind of see the real deal. I mean, he lives in Atlanta, doesn't perform all that often around town these days. So it's one to see. And he opens, he and his band open for Kool & the Gang. So it's going to be kind of a fun doubleheader that night.
Can we still claim him as Milwaukee's own, as Wisconsin's own, even though he lives in Atlanta?
If he's the godfather of Milwaukee soul or funk or whatever, then that's his nickname. I think we can still claim him, sure.
Okay, so
he just wants warmer weather. Who can blame him?
We started off with this. Let's give a little more to Love Itis by Harvey Scales.
You said the only one that can fill your prescription. Oh, yeah. And this feeling I've got. Got but one description. I think you got a thing called love. It's got a hold on me.
Should be a pretty good show, it sounds like, Piet.
Yeah, he's at 8 p.m. at the BMO Harris Pavilion on Independence Day, again, opening for Kool & the Gang. I think it will be a good one. Also, earlier we talked about Yipes was headlining a night of some Milwaukee bands that were reuniting. They are back in my brain who those other bands are. That includes the Wigs. They're playing at 8:30 on that stage. That's going to be one to definitely check out. And Bon Ton Society as well. They're playing at 6:30 on that stage.
And then wrapping up the festival on July 5th, Wisconsin's own Kane Place Record Club, not so much in the throwback category we've been doing. How long have they been around?
They've been around for a few years. They're really popular around town. I feel like they play basically any festival that happens in Milwaukee, and they get around a bit. They're just a really interesting band. They've got the soul thing going for them too, but they're kind of soul pop. Their tempos will change. They're really unpredictable. They're really exciting live. One of the best live bands we've got in Milwaukee right now. They've got this amazing music video for a single called Sunshine that and the song itself is like, and if you see the video, it reminds me of like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. There's like weird animation stuff happening, and the song just takes all these bizarre twists and turns. It's just kind of whimsical and funky, and it's cool. This band is very cool, so I think that'll be a lot of fun too. They're at 9 p.m. on the KNE New Music stage on July 5th.
Well, we'll play that exciting music video now. Everyone listening will just hear the audio portion, of course.
Yeah, check it out, jsonline.com/summerfest. We've got it up there.
All right, here's Sunshine.
I don't want to go to hell. My nickname was Sunshine. I was 12. I don't think about my grandma dying. Because the water won't rise unless you're crying.
So that's kind of the beginning of an epic, Piet?
Yeah, and it gets really kind of weird. It gets really dark and heavy, and then it gets really playful and jazzy, and I really haven't heard a song like it before. I mean, locally, beyond locally, I think they've really kind of tapped onto something very unique. And so, they're definitely popular here, and I think they'll continue to grow, and I think that set will be a lot of fun and should have a pretty good crowd of people, and hopefully listeners will check it out too if they're around on the 5th.
All right, Piet, we've hit a lot of the local Wisconsin act, or at least acts with Wisconsin ties. Which national act are you most excited to see of some of the ones you mentioned?
Oh, it's tough. I mean, I'm really excited for Usher because it's his only U.S. set this summer. I think that's really a cool get. He's got a song called Good Kisser that I think is really fun. It just came out, so it'll probably be the first time we hear that and first time we hear a lot of those songs from his upcoming album. I think Motley Crue will be kind of fun because it's their final tour, and I'm sure they're so over the top. I think they're just going to bring it for that. New Order should be great on the 3rd. Bonnie Raitt on the 2nd. Nas, he's celebrating the 20th anniversary of Illmatic, which is like a hip-hop classic. That should be really cool. Outkast, I'm pumped for Outkast. I can't wait to see them.
So I had a big boy and Andre for me. I got to ask before let you go, do you have dining plans? What foods are you looking to check out during Summerfest?
Well, at jsonline.com/summerfest, we have a list of TED food vendors to try out. I personally, I always get the Seals mini donuts with the powdered sugar and cinnamon sugar in there. It's not necessarily dinner, but it's delicious. You got to get the cheese sticks, of course, from Saz's, eggplant from Venice Club, which I think is 65 cents from noon to 3 on the 28th. It's like a throwback price.
Wow.
And then there's a new vendor called Burke's Lakeside, and they're doing mac and cheese bratwurst. That sounds awesome. So I'm going to definitely get one of those.
Put me down from eggplant with a little lemon with that. Piet, thank you for joining us today.
Cool. Thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate it.
That's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music writer Piet Levy sharing Wisconsin acts at this year's Summerfest.
Global poverty is an issue that affects both genders, but due to a variety of factors and limitations put on them, women are often hit harder than men, making the cycle of poverty harder to break.
But our next guest says there's hope, and women around the world are finding new ways of becoming self-sufficient and working to change the often impoverished worlds around them. In a new book, she writes about some of the success stories she's witnessed in her travels.
We're joined now by Ritu Sharma. She's a co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide and the author of the new book, Teach a Woman to Fish, Overcoming Poverty Around the Globe. Rita, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, there's a quote early in your book that you get the title from. When you teach a woman to fish, everyone eats. Can you talk about that quote and how it sort of sets the stage for your book?
Sure. I think we've all heard that old saying, when you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. When you teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime. And the reason that I say when you teach a woman to fish, everyone eats, is because women, particularly in poor countries, are usually responsible for the family's well-being, for their children. They have a tendency to share their income. And if they do catch a fish, they have a tendency to share it with their children and with the community. So often we find that when you teach women how to earn an income, you get really remarkable results.
There's a lot of data out recently that if you support women, especially in a family, that you get greater dividends back. Can you explain some of what that is and why it's working that way?
Yeah, for many countries in Africa or Latin America, just culturally, it is the role of the mother to provide for the children's education, nutrition, clothing, etc. And the father's income might contribute to that somewhat, but he's not expected that all of his income will be used to support the children. That's really the mom's responsibility. And so many mothers in developing countries will earn some income however they can to support their children's welfare. So when you kind of make that investment in women, you get a dividend for the family. Now, that's not to say the men are bad. That's not to say that, you know, all these guys that are not contributing to their families are horrible. What we have to keep in mind is that these are very, very different cultures. And the roles of men and women have been sort of this way for many, many hundreds of years. And it's going to take time to change that. And a lot of what needs to change is just men's awareness of what's happening.
It's an interesting thing. It seems as though when poverty comes up and it's approached from the angle, from the perspective of helping women, that sometimes a lot of the time has to be spent talking about including men and pointing out that men are not the enemy here. Men are impoverished and facing obstacles too. Do you think some resistance in approaching poverty explicitly from the perspective of women?
Yeah, and it's interesting. The resistance that I usually run into about approaching poverty just from the perspective of women is from women themselves. I'll just give you some really interesting examples. In Afghanistan, many women there talk about the need to extend, you know, microcredit or economic opportunity programs to their husbands because their husbands are at home without employment. They might be depressed and they might be armed. So it's really not in the interest of a woman, just at a very basic level of safety and security, for our government or others to kind of go out there and say, we're going to, you know, empower women without really addressing the challenges and the problems that men face as well. And what women really want is they would like to have a holistic approach. You know, their challenges may be different than their husband's, but that doesn't mean that, you know, their husband doesn't need assistance as well. And what they're looking for is something more holistic, where they can work together as a family to really lift themselves out of poverty. And what we find is that kind of approach really works, and it's much, much more sustainable.
And yet global poverty seems to hit women harder, and it seems to be harder for women to break out of the cycle of poverty. There are institutional roadblocks. There is cultural issues going on. Can you give us some examples about what is facing women as they try to break out of the cycle of poverty?
Yeah, let me take an example from Sri Lanka. We were doing some work there after the tsunami in 2004, and I went back last year to do some interviews with women about their lives since the tsunami. And one of the things these women said, very interestingly, was that they haven't been able to get ahead, you know, these last 8-9 years since the tsunami, because the government has started taxing basic products like sugar and tea and flour and rice much, much higher so that it could have the resources to rebuild the country. Well, when you think about whose income is really buying those products for the family, that's the woman's income. So tax policy in Sri Lanka has had a dramatic effect on women and families' ability to kind of lift themselves out of poverty after sort of the horrendous disaster there. And we don't usually think about something like that. What does tax policy have to do with, you know, with poverty? It actually has a lot to do with poverty. So from my point of view, it's not just about getting microcredit to a woman, but we have to build a banking infrastructure. We have to think about tax policy so that the environment that she is trying to progress within actually supports her.
And you talk about also how during the actual event of the tsunami that women were killed in much higher numbers than men were and were preyed upon afterwards.
Yeah, it was just an absolutely awful situation, but not surprising based on what we've seen with natural disasters in other parts of the world. It's a very typical experience that women cannot run as fast in the tsunami situation. Women who have very long hair in South Asia, women usually grow their hair all the way down to their waist, and it's beautiful, but their hair got tangled in the debris and pulled them underwater. Or they were wearing saris, which are impossible to run in when they're wet. Or they were in charge of their children or elderly parents, so they had to stay with them. So for many, many different reasons, many more women and girls died in that tsunami than men and boys. And it created just a horrible situation that, you know, the women that were left were very, very vulnerable. No, without any police force, without any security, they've lost their husbands, they're separated from their families. The men, you know, that were there took advantage of the chaos, and we got many, many, many reports of women being, quote-unquote, rescued from the tsunami, but then raped.
And one of the things your organization wanted to do after the tsunami was to make sure that the aid that was available got into the hands of these women. How did you go about doing that, and how has that been working in it as we go forward?
Well, one of the, I think, most important things that Women Thrive Worldwide does as an organization is that we reach out to women after things like this happen, because we want to hear from the local women themselves. What's happening? What do they need? What would they like to see an aid package from the U.S. government include? And how can we make sure that the money that our country is giving is really put to the best use? So we got in touch with organizations on the ground less than a week after the tsunami. And one of the things that we heard was that the very small women's organizations and women's networks that existed before the tsunami were not getting any assistance to really help the women in their associations or in their networks. And so we did what we do best at Women Thrive. We went up to the Hill and we took this information to members of Congress, and we said, you've got to take about out of the $1 billion package that is going to the tsunami-affected countries, we would like for you to just set aside $10 million. It's not very much, but in the context of $1 billion, but that money goes a long, long way on the ground with local organizations. We said, set that aside and make sure that at least that amount of money gets directly to the women's organizations on the ground that are helping women in their communities.
We're talking right now with international women's rights activist Ritu Sharma about how women are overcoming poverty around the world and the challenges that still face them.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you've worked in international aid, what strategies have you seen that work for women? And what challenges do you think still remain when it comes to breaking the cycle of international poverty? Again, 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Ritu Sharma, the author of Teach a Woman to Fish, about the challenges facing the poor around the world. And you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to try and break the cycle of international poverty, especially as we talk now about women and what women need to break that cycle? And have you personally seen any success stories? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And, you know, you write in your book that poverty isn't about having no money. It's more about having no power to change your circumstances. Can you explain about how your organization is working to change that and empower women?
Absolutely. I think what I have found in all the places where I've been and talked to women is that, you know, they understand that their poverty is not just about their lack of income. It's really about their inability to change their circumstances because, for example, they may need their husband's permission to get a job, or they can't go outside of their house without being accompanied by a male relative. You know, they need to begin to sort of build more power and more ability to change their circumstances within their families. And then that begins to expand and sort of radiate out into changing what their governments are doing. And one of the things that Women Thrive does really well is that we work with locally based women's organizations. And I'll give you an example, recent example from Haiti. We were there last year helping local groups that had done a lot of great work after the Haiti earthquake, but they had some issues with how the U.S. government was conducting its programs on the ground there in Haiti, and in particular, some suggestions about what could be done better on violence against women programming. And so we helped them learn how the U.S. government works, how they can talk to U.S. policymakers. We helped them to kind of self-create their own ask, their own agenda for the U.S. government. And then we opened a door for them to go and meet with the U.S. Agency for International Development based in Haiti. And we sat in the back and didn't do any of the talking and let the women really express what they wanted, how they wanted to basically see this aid system in their country change for the benefit of women. And that, since then, we've seen some really profound changes in the way that the U.S. government is doing business in Haiti, and it's doing a lot more to work with and interact with local Haitian women's groups. And that's a change in the system. That's not just a change in a woman's income. What that means is thousands of more women will have access to programs than otherwise would have.
Well, you talk about how it's in the interest of the United States to engage with other countries when it comes to solving issues of poverty and women's poverty in particular. Why do we benefit here in America when we try to do it and extend our reach abroad in terms of solving poverty?
Well, I think one of the most obvious ways that we benefit is from really addressing the immigration problem at its roots, truly. One of the reasons we see people from Central America, from the Caribbean, trying to come to the United States, even more and more children trying to come here, is because they don't have jobs, education, or safety and security. And so if we really want to do the right thing and the solution that will have the most long-term impact, that is to help these countries to develop their economies, and in particular, help those who are poor and very poor to overcome the poverty in their lives. That's just one way that it helps us. There are many other ways. It's a lot cheaper to put a development aid specialist on the ground than to put a soldier on the ground. That's another just very simple financial reality that is important for us to consider.
And you also write a lot about women helping other women. And one group you talk about here is the Coordination Association of Rural Women of La Paz. Can you talk a bit about what that group is doing?
Yes, COMUCAP is their short name, and they are a women's coffee and aloe cooperative in the hills of Honduras. And they actually got started to address domestic violence, and they didn't take on that issue directly. What they did is they gathered women in the community and helped them to start some economic development projects. And when these women began to have some income of their own, they were able to have more power in their household and reduce the violence against them and their children, or they were able to walk away from it. And from that beginning, COMUCAP has now really expanded their work, and now they actually export more than 10,000 pounds of fair trade coffee to Europe every year, and they've got a business that employs hundreds of local women in their community.
And let's move on to Nicaragua next. And here you write about the challenges facing farmers, and many of whom aren't the people we think of as traditional farmers. Can you talk about the extent to which women are the ones farming in the world today?
Yeah, I think it would surprise you to hear that 80% of the food that is eaten every day in the world is grown by women. So in most places in Asia and in Africa and even in Latin America, it's the food that women are growing in their kitchen gardens or in their fields that are feeding the family. And a lot of times the crops that men grow are what they sell for cash and for their income. So thinking about women in the context of programs that want to address hunger is very, very fundamental. And in Nicaragua, I got to see some wonderful programs that were really working with women in the community to help them develop sort of a cooperative farming association to grow beans and corn that was actually being purchased by the World Food Program to help address hunger in other parts of Central America. So, you know, sort of women helping each other in their community, but ultimately growing the food that's going to feed other hungry women, you know, who may be just in the country next door. It's a really, really phenomenal piece of work.
What kinds of cooperative farming techniques and policies are these women pursuing as they work together?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to do is to earn enough income from some of their initial farming to buy their own land. That's really critical for women because when they work on land that's either being lent to them or that they're renting, they don't really have any incentive to improve that land. And it's the same as all of us. When we rent a house, you don't really want to fix it up. But when you own a house, you're going to really invest in it. It's the same for farming. And what happens is if women cannot get to the place where they can own their own land, kind of their ability to grow better yields or to have higher quality products is never really going to happen for them. For this program in Nicaragua, that's the World Food Program project, the standards that they have to meet to sell their products to the World Food Program, they have to meet some pretty high standards for the produce, for the beans and the corn. And where they are right now is that the things that they are producing on rented land, they're making some money off of it, but it's not yet the high quality that they have for the World Food Program. So a really important step for these women along the way is to pool their resources and to be able to purchase their own piece of land.
So a lot of success stories there and progress made by different aspects here that we're talking about. But it sounds like you're saying that outside help is still needed. In your view, what do you think works best?
Oh, well, I think it's very, very simple. And we don't do this often enough. What works best is to really start where people are, start where women are, and sit with them and talk with them about what they need and want. Too often we go in with our solution that may be supported by, you know, volumes of data and analysis, and that's good. That's part of the context. But most importantly, women have the best analysis of why they're poor and what is going on in their homes or their communities that's keeping them poor, the most important thing we can do is really go and learn from them and go with a lot of humility and then provide support for what it is that they think is going to be the key.
I want to see if we can talk a little bit now about things that people can do individually. You write that women in America, Canada, European countries, that they have more in common, wealthy women, with these women trying to live on a dollar a day around the world than they think. So what are things that, you know, women can do to help other women if you're someone who has a little more money in the United States, for instance?
Well, I think one of the funnest things you can do and the easiest thing to do is to use your money to buy and reward the companies that are doing good things. I mean, the truth is that we love to shop as women. So let's just use that to benefit other women. And one of the things that I suggest in the book is that when you walk into any store, your favorite retailer, whatever that might be, that you ask the clerk, the associate on the floor, when they say, "Can I help you?" You say, "Yes, I'd like to know if you have an ethical trade policy. I want to feel good about what I buy in your store. I want to know that it was made, you know, paying people well, no child labor. Do you have a policy like that?" And 9 times out of 10, you know, the clerk will say, "No, my gosh, I've never heard of that. I don't know what you're talking about." And you ask them to just tell their manager that you asked. What I would love to see is that if thousands of us women who are out there shopping every day just started asking that simple question, "Do you have an ethical trade policy?" then we will begin to see some of these corporations shift their practices and pay women better wages, make sure there's no sexual harassment in factories, and also begin to reach out and employ women living in poverty, which they could do a much better job of that.
Well, Ritu, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ritu Sharma. She is the co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide and the author of the new book. It's called Teach a Woman to Fish, Overcoming Poverty Around the Globe.